I have had the distinct pleasure of introducing my dear friend Jim Wilson many times, but on no occasion have I looked forward with greater anticipation than this evening to this event. I've known Jim for at least 37 years, and I was present when he was writing this book that he's going to be discussing tonight, his commentary on the Xin Shen Ming, when that was happening back in the 80s. And I am so delighted that he has finally published it for the rest of us. I've been reading it myself and getting a great deal out of it and loving it. I know you will get much out of tonight's talk. And please join me in welcoming my dear friend Jim Wilson.
Thank you for coming tonight. It's wonderful to see you. All my good friends here, let's start with a few minutes of meditation. I want to start with a story which helped me understand Zen writing, particularly the really early writing from China, the Chan writings, you know, like the Sheng San died in 606. Like, so we're talking about very early in the history of Zen, since Bodhidharma came to China in the, I think around 520, something like that.
No, that's okay.
That's good. So, in the 70s, I went to Korea with my teacher, Zen Master Sun San, and he introduced me to one of his teachers. Not his main teacher, but his main teacher was Zen Master Ko Bong. This was a... But since he had three other Zen teachers who were Dharma brothers to Ko Bong, and Ko Bong had passed away years before I went to Korea. But Sunsnim introduced me to this other Zen master, and I went in for an interview, and his English wasn't very good, and my Korean was very, very inadequate. You know, like, I knew how to say hello, goodbye, and ask directions and that kind of thing. But so we were trying to communicate, you know, like, and it wasn't easy, and he was getting frustrated with me. And finally he said, you must understand your mind. You must understand your mind. And I'm saying, okay, well, that's a good idea. And he goes, no, you must understand your mind. You know, like, and then I go, well, yeah, that's, you know, that's one aspect of personality, blah, blah, blah. And I just go, no! And then he takes his stick and he hits me in the chest and goes, your mind. You know. You know, like, I said, mind, and he goes, mind!
Oh.
You know, like, mind! Oh. Mind! You know, like, and that was a big turning point for me in my practice. It shifted my attention, because I have an analytical tendency, I have a Western philosophical background, that kind of thing. And he... You know, he saw that that's what I was doing. You know, every time he said something, I was, you know, like, taking it in that direction. And after that experience, I began to take a second look at early Chinese Chan works. Because the word Qin is usually translated by Westerners in English as mind. And I believe the Japanese word is Kokoro, if that's helpful to people, some people here. But and the problem with that is exactly what I described. The word mind in English comes with a huge amount of understandings that aren't necessarily part of that term in Japanese. You know, like, for example, analysis and deduction and all those kinds of things. And it doesn't... And the problem with the word heart in English is that there's a tendency to make it sentimental. You know, like... You know, like, it's all heart. You know, like, or you gotta have heart, miles and miles and miles apart. Like, those kinds of songs, you know. Like. And, but I think heart is better. It's a better rendering than mind. You know, like, so the reason I bring that up is At the time, I was Sunstein had given me an English translation of Seng-san's poem, Xin Xin Ming, and the translation said, On Faith in Mind. You know, like, which actually is a title that several translators have used. You know, like, and I went through the translation and, you know, changed mind to heart. You know, like, and I also, over the years, developed a different understanding of what faith means. You know, faith is also an extremely heavily loaded term in this language. And so I felt, after all of that, that I came up with a title, On Trusting the Heart, instead of On Faith in Mind. I like to, because what Seng-san is speaking of is not a mode of analysis. You know, like, and he's, in a way, he's speaking about moving energy from here to here. You know, like, so. Please feel free at any point to ask questions. And so I'm just going to recite the some opening verses and some closing verses, and then I'm going to touch on a few specifics. You know, I can't go over the whole poem. If you want to go over the whole poem, you can buy my book. But Carl was mentioning that he'd heard the opening couplet is quoted a great deal, you know, like, but he didn't know the source for it. It's become, you know, something that's been spread around in the West a great deal. So Seng-san begins, the great way has no obstacles for those who do not pick and choose. When we cast preferences aside, the way stands clear and undisguised. But even slight distinctions made set earth and heaven far apart. If you would clearly see the truth, discard opinions, pro and con. To founder in dislike and like, names nothing but the mind's disease. And not to see the way's deep truth disturbs the mind's unending peace. The way resembles clear vast space, having no lack and no excess. And I'm going to now read a few of the concluding lines, beginning on page 5. Toward the bottom, the wise in all times and places. Incidentally, that quatrain there should have been a space between those two. Sorry about that. The wise in all times and places awaken to this primal truth. The way lies past all space and time. One instant means 10,000 years. Not only here, not only there, truth manifests before your eyes. Distinctions such as large and small have relevance for you no more. The largest means the smallest too. Your limitations have no place. What does exist does not exist. If this remains unclear to you, you dwell first from the inner truths. One thing means all things mean one. Know this, and all wholes and completes. When trust and heart do not separate, this lies beyond all words, all thought. For here, one finds no yesterday, no tomorrow, and no today. For decades, I chanted this, you know, like, and I highly recommend it if this poem attracts you. And this amalgamation was designed to assist in chanting, you know, like, so. The poem has a structure, you know, like, it's a spiral structure. It begins with what I would call psychological topics, you know, about preferences. You know, when we cast preferences aside, the way stands clear and undisguised. So it starts with things we can relate to on a personal basis. And it'll spiral back to that theme periodically as the poem progresses. But each time it reaches a higher level until at the end he enters, having dissolved all opposites, he enters into the timeless and the space. You know, it lies past all space, all time. One instant is 10,000 years. You know, like, and for here there is no yesterday, no tomorrow, and no today. And you step into that domain. You know, like, but what he does on the way there is he'll periodically unpack different kinds of opposites, preferences, like, dislike, light and dark, things we cling to, things we reject, you know, like, and he'll spiral back to one of those, you know, as he's going higher and higher. You'll see it when you read the whole poem. You know, like, he'll return to that and say, you know, and another aspect of the poem, which is very, you find it frequently in Buddhist wisdom literature, Taoist wisdom literature, where he'll use a term one way in one couplet, and then a little ways down, he'll use the term a different way. So I'll give you an example. So, I'm reading from my commentary here. One of the couplets says, "Just calmly see that all means one, and by themselves false views vanish." So here he's using oneness as an anecdote to a fragmented mind. So just calmly see that all means one, and by themselves false views vanish. And then later, a couple pages later, he says, "When rest and no rest both vanish, then even oneness disappears." He's very, Seng-sun is very sharp about, you know, just in case you thought you were going to land on oneness, and that was going to be the place, you know, where you're going to, you know, establish, you know, like a couple of couplets later, you know, he'll take that, he'll remove that as well, and that's part of the spiral. Maybe it's a double helix. I should look into that. You know, like structure of the poem. You know, like, well, he'll introduce a term and use it as a tool to cut through a certain type of clinging. You know, like, or fragmenting of the mind. You know, like. But he's very keenly aware that, you know, now I've got the perfect tool, now I've got the method, you know, like, and so later on in the poem, he'll say, well, you know, like, just in case you thought that was the purpose for me doing this, he'll take that away as well. You find that that method is very typical of what I would broadly call mystical literature, you know, like in the Heart Sutra. It says, toward the beginning, it says, "Form does not differ from emptiness. Emptiness does not differ from form. That which has form has emptiness. That which has emptiness has form." Then later in the Heart Sutra, it says, "In emptiness, no form. No feeling, no perception, no impulse, no consciousness." The Heart Sutra is very brief, so it does it very quickly. You know, like, in fact, it can be kind of jolting. You know, like, or in Mystical Theology by Dionysus, he begins the Mystical Theology, which is also very short. It's just five pages, and not very dense pages. You know, like, he begins with a hymn to the Trinity because he's a Christian, so it's this exaltation of the Trinity. But in section 5, which is the climactic section, he undermines each one of those three, Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit, that you have to go beyond those. And so it's very interesting how you can see this pattern, this way of using language and this way of using concepts. It's very skillful. It's not easy to pull it off. If your writing isn't coherent, the tendency will be for people to get annoyed by it. That you're trying to pull something over on me. Mm-hmm. So you really have to introduce what I call this spiral motion, into the work, so that people feel like they're being carried along. And Saint-Saëns manages to do that.
It sounds as if every time you get to a point where you think with your mind that you understand something, you don't.
Right. Well, you don't understand this ultimate nature that he's trying to introduce to you. Saint-Saëns, the poem by Saint-Saëns, is a big challenge to human, to the human way, to the way we humans live in the world, because who am I if I'm not my preferences and my likes and dislikes? I can understand people reading this and getting annoyed because it's sort of like, what are you saying? What are you saying about me? What are you saying about anybody? And so it's hard to understand what he means, when he says stop picking and choosing, stop this kind of preferences. It's helpful to understand where Saint-Saëns is coming from and a little bit about his life. And in the introduction, I talk about that. It's interesting about in China, it didn't have an auspicious beginning. If you looked at the early generations of Chinese Chan, you wouldn't have seen a seed of potential there. Bodhidharma, he was a rough character. A rough cut diamond, not unpolished. He could be very abrupt. There are a few sermons of his that are, and he was not very, he didn't hold people's hands. He would ask questions and answer questions in a very abrupt and the one that I remember is one of his students asked him an elaborate question about the Lankavatara Sutra, because Bodhidharma was he liked the Lankavatara Sutra. He was very fond of it. And so he asked him this theological complex question, and Bodhidharma lets him go on, and then he finishes, and then Bodhidharma's answer was, "You're just dreaming." And because of this kind of abruptness, his personality leaned in that direction. He did not attract a large following. Today we think of Bodhidharma as this great culture bearer, and he was a great culture bearer. But I'm talking about at the time, he only had 6 students. That was it.
What was his time period?
Well, 520. Our era. And then he gave transmission to Hui Ko, my Chinese pronunciation is abysmal, but and Waco was one-armed. As a child, he had had one of his arms cut off by in a bandit raid at his village. You know, like and he was a very dedicated practitioner. You know, like and but he wasn't charismatic or and he had very few followers. One of them was Sengsan. You know, like, and Sengsan didn't approach Waco until he was like 40, in his early 40s, which is late, you know, like. And the thing that precipitated his going to see Waco was he came down with leprosy. Mm. You know, like, so that'll do it. Yeah, like, and like anybody in that kind of situation, you ask yourself, you know, like, why me? You know, like, you know, what a, and he asked Waco, you know, like, I have leprosy. I beg you, great priest, to cleanse me of my wrongdoing. So this is a very common, you know, feeling, you know, that people have, you know, like, that I must have done something wrong, you know, like, so, you know, like, and in traditional Buddhist karmic theory, that's right. You know, like, something you did in your past life has, you know, like, so that's, you know, my picture of Sengsan is a somewhat knowledgeable Buddhist layman. This happens to him. Oh my, you know, what's going on? What kind of karma is manifesting now? I'll go to this teacher, you know, like, and, but Sengsan answered, bring me your wrongdoing and I will cleanse you. So Sengsan didn't give him a karmic analysis, you know, like, didn't give it, he said, you know, show me your wrongdoing, you know, like, and so that was a, if you had been raised with the idea that bad things happen to you because of this karmic heritage, and then you go to a Buddhist teacher and they don't give you that answer, it's kind of a shock. Like, so you have to get that background, you know, and the oomph, you know, of that interaction. So that was very liberating for Sengsan. You know, like, and he studied with them. There was a local persecution of Buddhism at that time when he was studying with Huiko, and Huiko was executed. You know, like, and Sengsan, you know, continued taught one-on-one during this time. The episode passed, and he came out to teach publicly. But like, he never like had a Dharma center or a monastery or that kind of thing. And his personality was seems to have been very open and warm, you know, like, and he had quite a few students, you know, like, and one person he transmitted to took the Zen teachings to Vietnam, the first transmission outside of China, and then one of the students was Dao Xin, and Dao Xin created the first really significant Zen teaching monastery, you know, like, and from there, Zen took off. But, you know, I mean, the beginning of Zen was this kind of belligerent guy and this one-armed failure and a leper.
Yeah, so he had all those followers and he had leprosy and...
Well, yeah, he did, you know, and it's interesting about leprosy has various manifestations and various ebbs and flows, and I know the Chinese word is translated as leprosy, you know, like, so I'm going with that, you know, like, but it's a very slow-moving disease, or it can be, you know, extremely slow-moving. Sengsan died while he was giving a Dharma talk, and in the middle of the Dharma talk, he paused and said thank you to everyone, and then passed. passed away. So, you know, that question, but the reason I bring up this story, it's a good story, don't you think? But one of the reasons I bring up this story is, if you see this poem through Sengtan's eyes, a good situation is a bad situation. A bad situation is a good situation. It was his leprosy which led him to Hui Ko. And so, like, if you have that background, all of a sudden some of these, you know, teachings, you go, oh, you know, like, I get it. You know, like, he wasn't thinking abstractly about these issues here. You know, like, I mean, this really is from his life and from his heart. You know? My teacher, Sansanim, used to say a good situation is a bad situation is a good situation. And people would ask him what he was talking about, and then he'd say, well, when everything is going well, people don't want to practice the spiritual path, you know, like, so it's bad. and when the situation is terrible, then people go, what's going on? What does it mean? You know, like, so, Sensei was Korean, you know, like, and he had lived through some of the Japanese occupation and then the Korean War, so he had a lot of first-hand experience with good and bad situations. So, I have a little story about this. The second time I was in Korea with Sensei, we went to a temple high in the mountains, and we arrived at night, and we actually climbed up the side of the mountain during the night. I'm so glad I had no idea what it looked like. There was like no railing, you know, as we were going up this mountain. Anyway, and we ended up on this plateau, which was not at the top of the mountain. It was maybe two-thirds up. And I woke up in the morning, and I didn't realize this, but there have been meditators there for 1,100 years. Yeah, like, and there was this ledge, and I looked out over the vista, and it was framed by ancient pine trees, and there was this river tumbling down the mountain. It was just like this perfect East Asian watercolor. I was just breathless, you know, like, and I didn't hear Sunstein coming up behind me, but he saw me sort of looking out over all of this, and he leaned over and he goes, sometimes a good situation is a good situation. So one of the ways to understand Sengsan's emphasis on picking and choosing and preferences is to I found it helpful to pick extremely coarse examples when people do it in an extremely coarse way, you know, like as an illustration. So one of the examples I like to use is bigotry and hatred. So if somebody meets a stranger who is the object of their hatred, you know, embodies in some way, racially or some other way, you know, like, they are intensely picking and choosing, and they do not even see the person in front of them. Literally. I mean, they literally do not see the person in front of them. What they see is their own mind. Mm-hmm. They see their own mind. So, like, and so this is, you know, if you take something like really harsh like that, very, I keep using the word coarse, I can't think of a better, you know, like, word, you know, harsh. And then, if you've known such people, when I worked on the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, I was actually pretty much surrounded by people like that. and they will not move from that commitment. They will not move from that spot. You know, like Sensenim used to call it rock's mind. They have rock's mind. But what I want to suggest is that all of us are involved with that to some degree. I mean, I'm not saying that we're equally culpable of the kind of damage, you know, like an extremely coarse example gives to the world. You know, like, the difference in degree is significant, and I wouldn't dismiss it. But over and over again, what we see, we do not see the world, we see our own mind. You know, we see our likes and dislikes. Another way of approaching this is to think about what you liked and disliked when you were 15. And what you like and dislike now. Sometimes it can be embarrassing, actually, but but that's all right. That's kind of fun. I mean, to actually write a list. You know, when I was 15, I really liked, and now I really like, and I dislike da 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 da, and now I dislike. You know. So that can be illuminating, because our likes and dislikes, we tend to think of them as quite solid and fixed. You know, like, and so this gives us like an insight into how they are changing all the time. But we seem to move from certainty to certainty about those, you know, rather. One of the things I've done with Zen and Buddhist thought is I've been very attracted to seeing it through Western categories. You know, like, how do Western categories of understanding of spirituality map onto these? You know, like, how do they work together? And throughout this book, I bring in the Western philosophical tradition, from Anaximander, who was a pre-Socratic philosopher, to Alfred North Whitehead, and I find it very refreshing and nourishing to weave these together, you know, like, and the world is getting smaller, and this kind of dialogue is very useful. At least I find it very useful and very nourishing. On page 78, in a commentary on the couplet, "The great way has no boundaries beyond the easy and the hard," you know, like, I discuss the idea of the boundaryless in the Western tradition, and it has a very rich and interesting history. So the word in Greek is apeiron, apeiron, without boundary, and you'll find it in early Greek literature meaning, like, Homer uses it meaning that the field didn't have a fence. It was apeiron, but Anaximander, he introduced the idea that the condition of no boundary is the actual condition of existence. It is the primary is the primary nature of things. So Simplicius, writing about Anaximander, said, Anaximander, son of Praxiades in Milesian and successor and pupil of Tyles, said that the principle and element of existing things was apeiron, being the first to introduce this name as the ultimate principle. He says it is neither water nor any of the other so-called elements, but some other apeiron nature from which come into being all the heavens and the world in them. So this introduction of this word, and giving this word, elevating this word, So Anaximander was the first one. Previous philosophers, everything is ultimately water, everything is ultimately fire, everything is ultimately air, Or Empedocles said earth, water, fire, air, love, and strife, the six elements of existence. But Anaximander was the one who opened this way of looking at things that the Greek world found amazingly difficult to absorb. It took centuries. 500 years, for the Greek world to absorb the introduction of this idea. Aristotle rejected the idea. I said there can be no actually existing apeiron. And in his metaphysics, and that kind of thing. So it isn't until you get into the Neoplatonists where the idea is completely absorbed and reintroduced and worked with, and the world, the cosmic world, opens up into this mystical boundaryless dimension. It's a very interesting history. In China, it doesn't seem to have had that kind of tension around it. I don't know as much about Chinese philosophical history as I do about Western philosophical history, but I bring this up because, what Sengsun is teaching, there's a kind of, instinctive resistance to the idea, of this dimension of existence that's beyond all space and time, that has no boundary, and I think part of it is fear-based. Where are we standing? Where are we, if the great way lies past all space and time, if it has no boundary, if it's beyond the easy and the hard, then where are we? I know I had an experience with Sun Tzu once when he was chanting. He would chant some Bodhisattva vows every morning. There were 10 that he chanted, which come from the Avatamsaka Sutra. And they are, I will freely project myself through all space to save sentient beings in all realms. I will ceaselessly be reborn life after life until all sentient beings and every blade of grass is free from suffering. So I was his attendant at the time, and I suddenly realized that he was serious about what he was saying, and I felt like I was falling off a cliff. Because I felt kind of safe, I allowed that to continue, and that sense of spaciousness and boundarylessness, I think it can stimulate that kind of reaction of wanting to pull away from the cliff edge. But the thing is, when you step into that spaciousness, there's no bottom. You're not really falling. You know, like you think you are at first. You know, like, but there's, you're not going to, you know, all of a sudden find yourself at the bottom of the cliff needing medical attention. So in this section, what I do with up and around and boundarylessness is I apply it to many different aspects of life. You know, like, so when we apply up and around to the category of time, for example, the no boundary nature of time is eternity. When we enter into that dimension which has no boundary from the perspective of time, we are stepping into eternity. So it's a wonderful understanding to apply to various aspects of existence. So when we apply the no boundary understanding to matter, we come across it's the bottomlessness of materiality. Like, so how, you know, like, it falls apart. Matter falls apart and becomes spacious. Matter falls apart and if you try and chop it and chop it, it gets into dust, and then it gets into, you know, like chemicals, and then atoms, and then subatomic particles, and then it's just whirling spaciousness. And you can do this to the sense realm as well. Like in vision, when does the sunrise begin? When has a flower finally blossomed? It's really a wonderful this idea of the boundaryless. If you take it in and take it to heart, and you see it manifesting in all the facets of your life, then it opens up that spaciousness wherever you are.
Jim, I don't understand why it took 5 centuries for the Greeks to catch on to Apeiron. Because it seems to make sense to me. And so, I mean, I get the implication that there was a way, he was saying in a way, that the manifest world comes from an unbounded, unmanifest place. Mm-hmm. Is that similar?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, if there were a fence around the unmanifest, well, then it would be limited and it couldn't bring forth everything.
Yes.
So
I want you to get into a time machine and tell them that.
Well, I'm wondering if it came about over 5 centuries because of repetition, or did people actually begin to understand it finally?
I see an evolution in Greek thought about this, you know, like, Anaxagoras' introduction of this was a very powerful elixir, you know, in the culture over time, you know, like, but it was slow to ripple out. You know, like, and the reactions to it were, you know, like, well, that doesn't make sense. You know, like, I mean, that, you know, like, that doesn't, you know, like, that doesn't compute. You know, like, and I can sympathize, you know, with that, You know, like I get it. You know, like because if that kind of understanding undermines identity, it undermines group identity, like an identity in a city-state. You know, like
it undermines everything fixed.
It undermines everything fixed.
Yeah. The other tradition is the Aristotelian tradition, which holds on to everything fixed, and leads to modern science.
Right.
So it's still strong in our culture.
Oh yeah.
As modern science.
Absolutely.
It's strong in our culture as human beings.
Yeah.
You know, like that. This is one of the dilemmas that human beings face. It's difficult to overcome these tendencies of limitation.
I'm reading this book, Pristine Affluence, by a Taoist scholar, Lily Cohn. And she makes the point about that you made earlier, that the Zen teacher, that Sung San's teacher, one of his teachers, made to you about heart and mind.
Right.
And so, and in this book, you talk about the relocation of the center of gravity of attention from the mind to the heart.
Right.
And I'm wondering if that doesn't help us understand how there can be resistance in the way that Carl just mentioned and others, and the way to acceptance of a boundaryless view.
The descent of the energy into the heart. So when you feel connected with someone, you feel that right here. You know, like you feel it in the chest. You know, like, and this is true whether you whether the connection is pleasing or unpleasing. And that's the wisdom of the heart. The wisdom of the heart is the wisdom of connectedness. Right? And so cultivating the wisdom of the heart, I believe the foundation of cultivating the wisdom of the heart is the cultivation of gratitude. Right? So gratitude is a feeling that arises in the center of the chest. Right? And it is a feeling that can be cultivated. It also happens naturally when you enter into meditation, and this is Seng San's route, through the Chan tradition. Because the Chan process of meditation is to allow whatever appears to appear, and whatever disappears to disappear. So that normally the brain uses an extremely large amount of our energy checking, categorizing, placing and analyzing and doing that kind of activity. When you allow it to simply appear and disappear without engaging in it, then the energy drops into the heart center or deeper into the Tantian, and it nourishes the heart wisdom and allows it to open up. And the explicit cultivation of gratitude and entering into meditation, into spaciousness, combined will allow the heart wisdom to grow.
I would like you now to bring it back to the Shinshin Ming.
Yeah. So in order to overcome all these opposites that Seng San is talking about, you have to trust the heart. And I was looking for the place in the commentary where I say that, but I'm sorry I can't. So trusting the heart is happens with experience. Now, Sensan was extremely fortunate because he trusted Rico. There has to be a foundation in trust that there is another way of relating to this world that isn't based on analysis and this kind of division and opposites. And the best way that I have found to connect with that other way is to find somebody who is always already living that way. So Sengsan found someone who was relating at that level, and using him as an example, he could enter into that meditation and follow his, the route of the heart, the way of the heart. So Sengsan's this poem is written from the perspective of someone who has, is it, I see it as written from this perspective of someone who is looking back on his journey, and seeing how all of these things can be overcome. And he's inviting us to also walk that way of trusting the heart.
And then I'll further observe that the stuff you were talking about at the beginning and the stuff in the book that I've been reading, your book, sort of is a very subtle back and forth, but with a progression of pointing to the ways in which we get stuck in the ego mind grasping after a view and holding on to something, which then means we're stuck.
Thank you.
And if you have more to say about that, I'd love to hear it.
I will get to you in 1 second. I see you there, my good friend. There is a this tendency, part of the fear is that, let's see, I'm trying to think of a good example from the book. Today, in this world that we live in, we're embedded in an extremely agitated time. And one of the difficulties we face with following Sengsan's way is that we think we'll be like used or crushed, that we have to make these distinctions. But one way of looking at this and resolving this dilemma is to understand that all of these ideas that we have are tools that we can use to, and when we use them effectively, they assist our life. But when we cling to them and reify them and turn them into some kind of ultimate, then they become obstacles, or worse, So let me give an example. If I was a gardener and I got this hoe, somebody gave me a hoe as a present, and it's just the best hoe I have ever had. I mean, it just, those rows just magically line right up, it's just the neatest. So I decide that I'm going to trim my hedge with the hoe. because this is, because it's a great hoe, so I go to the hedge, it doesn't work, or if I take a rake, in fall, and it's a great rake, and I rake up all the leaves, and then I decide I'm going to paint the house, and I get the paint, and I dip the rake in the paint, and I start you know, like to paint the house, you know, like. But we use our ideas that way. You know, we do that with our ideas. You know, like, I got this great idea. And one of the ways you can tell that a person has done that, including ourselves, is that we want to relate every single thing in existence to that idea. We're going to put it, you know, it somehow is connected to that, somehow related to that, somehow, you know, it becomes almost maniacal at times.
The man with the hammer.
Right, the man with the hammer. You know, like, and so, sing-song, you know, like, sometimes when people read a poem like this, they think, well, you know, like, I had oatmeal this morning and I didn't have toast. Is he saying that's wrong? You know, like I mean, I preferred oatmeal to toast. Oh my God, I've lost the way. You know, like so, but it's not like that. You know, like it's learning how to hold these ideas effectively and lightly. You know, like. Without attachment. Can you put down an idea which no longer functions? You know, can you put it down and leave it? You know, like, so it's not easy, especially if you put in a lot of time and investment, you know, into a particular idea. You know, like, so. Will, you had a question I don't want to ignore.
Okay. Well, it wasn't really a question, it was just a comment. Because when you're talking about the heart and your and the limitless and well, back to before when you're talking about limitless, I thought about light. Right. Light is the one thing that's limitless without boundaries. Right. And then you were talking about the heart, and in the Philokalia that I spent years reading, yeah. Their form of meditation or contemplation, which they actually describe in the book, is. No, it involves breathing, but one of the main things was associated with heart over mind. So they actually recommended that your chin drop to your heart so that your center goes to your heart when you actually do your contemplative practice. Mm-hmm. And of course, every contemplative in Orthodox mysticism is hoping they're going to see the divine light, or the, they call it the uncreated light, which again gets back to the limitless. So. It's just very all connected to what you're
Thank you.
Talking
that's
about.
That's beautiful. Thank you very much.
Right.
I'm going to conclude with just talking a little bit about me and Sing-Song because I wrote this 30 years ago and I was, you know, like and so I spent a lot of time with the guy, you know, like and when I decided to, you know, finally publish this. It was very interesting to me to see how my ideas have changed, you know, like, and one of the things I learned from Sing-Song is, you know, like, how he spirals back, you know, like, and so there's this idea, you know, that he offers, and you go, oh, that's cool, you know, like, go get rid of that, and then he goes, no, get rid of that one, too, you know, like, so at the time I wrote it, I was, you know, like, I didn't have this clear understanding that what Sing-Song was offering was an understanding of ideas and tools and how that functions in the spiritual realm. Like, so, it, for example, take non-dualism, which he talks, you know, immediately affirm not to, and this not to all means the same, with nothing separate or outside. The wise in all times and places awaken to this primal truth. You know, like, so he often uses the term not to, but he also there's also non-duality, non-dualism is also there as well. And the wonderful thing about that is it takes you to the one. You know, like, it takes you to the one. You know, like, and it, you know, like, this kind of teaching, you know, like, that never mind the differences, what unites everyone? What is, you know, they all come from this primal source, this great origin, you know, like, and so non-dualism is this great tool, you know, like, to do that. But then he also says, you know, you have to give up the one. You know, like, so I as my understanding deepened, I began to see that, well, you know, actually dualism is a tool. It's not a bad thing. Dualism is a useful tool in some instances. You know, like, so it allows me to understand the difference between an oncoming truck and a rock in the road. I mean, to me, this was a big deal. Sorry, you know, like, but you know, like, seeing how these spiritual understandings. I mean, my search for many years was to kind of nail down the spiritual rhetoric, you know, like, and to. I'm inclined that way. I still, you know, sort of have an instinct, you know, like, to do that, you know, like. But Saint San has been an unfailing companion for me to remind me and tap me on my shoulder to. It's not that it's bad to do that, Jim. Like, but you have to see it in perspective, you know, like, and you have to see it. And by perspective, I mean from the perspective of eternity, from the perspective of the boundless, from the perspective of that which has no boundary. And then all of it falls into place. You know, like, it's really quite beautiful, you know, like, when that happens. Yeah?
So, giving up the one wouldn't that be the same... Giving up the one wouldn't that be the same as ego, giving up ego or self, or like Madame Goyon, which you talked about.
Uh-huh.
She talks about the selfless, and psychologists talk about that being the self or the ego. But giving up that would be like flowing, like rivers flowing into an ocean, and the river disappears when it goes into mm-hmm. the ocean.
Yeah.
Would that be kind of a context of what he's talking about?
I like it. Thank you. So I mentioned that I chanted the Xinqin Ming daily for decades, actually. And one of the things I did was that I put it to a melody, and I thought I would share just a few verses at the conclusion.
Where did the melody come from?
Yeah, I made it. I made the melody.
Yes. It's original.
Good. Yeah. The way lies past all space and time. One instant means 10,000 years. Not only here, not only there. Truth manifests before your eyes. Distinctions such as large and small have relevance for you no more. The largest means the smallest too. Here limitations have no place. What does exist does not exist. If this remains unclear to you, you dwell far from the inner truth. One thing means all things mean one. Know this and all wholes and complete. When trust and heart do not separate, this lies beyond all words, all thought. For here one finds no yesterday, no tomorrow, and no today. Thank you, my friends. Thank you for coming tonight. I hope you enjoy Saint-Saëns' poem. And I had a wonderful time. Thank you for sharing it with me.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. And of course, thank you, Jim, for this lovely evening. Thank you all for coming tonight. Of course, most of you know that we have a donation bowl over there. We encourage you to contribute to it. And we share that with our speakers to further their work. We also have only a couple copies because the book has been selling, trusting the heart over there. But we'll be getting more in soon, and then other books of Jim's poetry as well over there. And thank you all for coming tonight.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Jim, how do you spell something? F-E-U-N-G-S-A-H-N.
Sometimes have books by him on the shelf.
Yeah.
I don't know what we have at the moment.
Yeah, the cups of Ben. Can you say what cannot be said?
Monday is
Wednesday.
First Friday is
Mystic. That's all you do, Jim.
I say what
you always say what cannot be said.
That's
what your heart is about.
Oh, thank you.
Brad has just recently taken over.
I don't have anybody to tell me. I'm going to go look at the calendar. Is there something? I'm on Lisa's mail.
Get on Dan's yoga.
I'm having such a hard time with my
list. Dan's yoga. Yes. Amazing by
That was Because you were
Throwing
I still do that.
Well, to heaven.
Just because Jim's fault for writing so many books.
This is why.
We have, if you put the full paper for the month, we have everything here.
No.
Yeah.
That's right.
It's really handy. You try to put all the pertinent stuff on there, including the.
It seems like there's more and more and more.
There is. I like this idea,
Alan, good to see you again.
Good to see you, Chance.
Carl?
Thanks.
Good to see you.
Carl, how are you?
I'm doing well.
Are you?
Do you want to wait further or do you want to just go for it?
No, just go for it.
Good.
Good for the last part. I'm slowing down.
Thank you for bringing me back from my Greek excursion.
I know your mind at this point. I'm happy to help push it back. And when you did, when you went there, it was very nice. Very lovely.
Okay. I think I moved. Your jacket and copy of the poems. I moved it over there so we could pull the which ones here.
Going along, you know.
So I'm going to have lots of questions.
Oh, I thought your talk was wonderful.
Thank you.
I've always been struck by the Chinese term Shen that you were talking about. There's basically no distinction between
Yin and Yang.
So we have all this difficulty with separation.
You must have lots of money. You can just throw it around.
And that's one of the reasons why I think when I came in to introduce that idea, I think that separation was already there.
Yeah.
And so it's like, you know, if you think about the boundary, you know, like, then you can think of all sorts of good reasons why that doesn't make sense. Yeah, like, but in Herzl's Metaphysics, where he argues about the irrationality of the concept of infinity, operon was translated into Latin as infinity, you know, like, so that's the connection, you know, like, and so what he's really doing is arguing there against the fact that there's no such thing as an actually existing infinity.
Now, I'm going to ask you each to pull that chair on the other side and sit down instead of squatting.
That was his view.
There's still people who have that view.
I was talking to you.
Oh, just hit stop.